Due to the themes of this podcast, listener discretion is advised. Lock your doors, close the blinds, change your passwords. This is Secrets and Spies. Secrets and Spies is a podcast that dives into the world of espionage, terrorism, geopolitics, and intrigue. This episode is presented by Matt Fulton and produced by Chris Carr.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Secrets and Spies. On today's episode, The Washington Post's Pulitzer Prize-winning intelligence correspondent, Shane Harris, joins me to discuss the Discord leaks and the Air National Guardsman who, earlier this week, pleaded guilty to charges of willful retention and transmission of U.S. national defense information, an act that's been called the largest disclosure of classified material in years. Shane shares his reporting on who this man is, what he leaked, and his bewildering motivations for doing so. Before we get started, if you enjoy the show, please leave a 5-star rating and review on your podcast streaming app of choice. And if you're not already, please consider supporting us on Patreon. It's super easy. Just go to patreon.com/secretsandspies. Your generosity helps keep this podcast going. Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoy our conversation.
The opinions expressed by guests on Secrets and Spies do not necessarily represent those of the producers and sponsors of this podcast.
Shane Harris, welcome back to Secrets and Spies. It's great to have you on again.
Thanks, Matt. It's nice to talk to you again, too.
Yeah, as always. So for any listeners who may be unfamiliar with your work, tell us a bit about you and what you cover for The Washington Post.
Yeah, sure. So I am the intelligence correspondent here at The Post. So I cover the CIA, the DNI, all things related to espionage, the sort of secret worlds of spies. And I'm on our national security team, so I often work with a lot of colleagues who cover the State Department, the Pentagon, Justice Department, and related things like that.
Thanks for that. So a year ago tomorrow, you were on the show to talk about your reporting on the Nord Stream pipeline. That was my first interview that we aired, so I thought it'd be fun to ask you back on to talk about the Discord leaks. You've largely quarterbacked the Post coverage of this story. It's been called like the largest disclosure of U.S. classified material since Edward Snowden. To ease us in, tell us what sort of information began coming to light and how you became aware of it.
Well, it was last, almost a year ago now, I guess, that one afternoon, some classified military documents related to the war in Ukraine started popping up on social media. They were being seen on Telegram. Some were posted, were swirling around on Twitter. And a lot of reporters kind of scrambled to figure out, what are these documents doing there? They looked like they were military briefings. They were on things like casualty numbers, you know, sort of state of the war documents. And we, like others, started digging into that. And what we determined was that these documents had first made their way onto the internet via a server on Discord, which is the platform that's really popular with people who play video games. It helps them play video games in real time. They can exchange text and video. They can share gaming platforms and screens. And my colleague Sam Oakford and I, as we dug into this, managed to basically find the original Discord server that these documents had emanated from, and started digging into that, and eventually were able to speak to people who have been members of that server, and also obtain a larger tranche of documents that were placed there by someone who was described to us by this initial core of members in the Discord server. Fast forwarding, we now know that individual to be a now 22-year-old member of the Air National Guard named Jack Teixeira. He had printed out classified documents at work, where he worked in Massachusetts in an intelligence facility on an airbase. He was a computer tech, basically, who had a top secret security clearance and was fascinated by secret information, wanted to show off to his friends the kind of accesses that he had, was very closely following world events, including the war in Ukraine, and would basically read and write down or print out classified reports about all these subjects that were interesting to him and then post them to Discord. He did this for quite a long time before he got caught. So the Discord leaks really are the product of all of this information that this young guy, this kid really, was basically able to steal from work and share with his friends.
If we could, let's sort of dial the clock back a bit and say, like, who is Jack DeShera?
So Jack DeShera was born in North Dighton, Massachusetts, and grew up there, kind of in a relatively small kind of suburban town. From a young age, he was fascinated by military hardware, military gear. He was very interested in World War II aircraft when he was a small kid. And then around middle school, got very into video gaming, like a lot of kids do, and was very interested in games simulating warfare, shooter games, those types of things. Now, fairly normal childhood, it would seem. And when he gets to high school, he starts exhibiting some troubling behaviors, mostly involving violence and threats of violence. He was suspended for one day from high school for threatening to bring weapons to school. Police found that he had made threats to students. He had made threatening racial remarks when he was young. I say all of that to note that in addition to being kind of maybe a troubled kid, this comes up and becomes a subject of interest when, after graduating high school, he is enlisting in the Massachusetts Air National Guard and is applying for a top secret security clearance. Because in order to do his job as a computer tech at this facility where he ends up working, he needs a clearance to help maintain computers and computer networks that contain classified information. He's working essentially for people who are doing intelligence analysis and support for the military, and he has to be able to get on classified computer networks to maintain them. So in the course of him applying for this security clearance, these issues about troubling incidents in his past come up and apparently are deemed not sufficient to deny giving him a clearance, all of which becomes kind of a point of issue later when he gets this job in this intelligence facility, and he is spotted by his superiors poking around and reading classified documents when he's not supposed to be, and is warned several times to stop doing this, does it anyway, tells friends that he knows he's not supposed to be sharing the information, but he doesn't care. What you start to emerges from this is a picture, I think, of a kid who has a pretty big anti-authority streak, who is very distrustful of the government for which he's working, has a lot of paranoid conspiracy theories about things that the government is up to, and seems in part to be looking around in classified documents to prove those theories sometimes. So it's this really fascinating portrait of someone who, in this vast intelligence apparatus that we have today, where hundreds of thousands of people have these top secret security clearances, this kid with one of those clearances, it basically has free rein at his job to go swimming around through classified networks, looking at all kinds of documents that are just interesting to him, and then shares them with his friends, and doesn't stop when he's told to do it, and ultimately doesn't stop until he's arrested. So it's a pretty fascinating portrait to me of a kid who grew up online. His friends were all online. These people who he shared documents with, he never actually met in person. He met them during the pandemic and formed a Discord server. And it became this sort of, for me, a very fascinating story of the pandemic and what it did to people, particularly young people who were in isolation and turned to technology as their only source of contact with other people and seemed to have lost a real sense of reality and consequences for their actions.
I want to put a pin in the vetting issues to get back to that in a second. So let's dig a bit more into the community he was kind of stewing in on Discord, what it was like, who he was surrounded by, and kind of like how he got into that.
So before the pandemic, around about 2019 or so, he had been in a Discord server that was populated by people who were fans of a YouTuber that specialized in profiles about guns and military hardware, sort of like a Guns and Gear YouTube channel. And he fell in with some friends there who, accounts differ whether they were kicked out of this YouTube or Discord server or left it on their own, but they were becoming problematic for a lot of the racially insensitive jokes that they would make, anti-Semitic remarks they would make, basically, as other members, I think, would characterize it, just causing a lot of trouble and saying things that they really found distasteful and offensive. And so these kids, with Jack kind of at the center, peel off and form their own Discord server that becomes kind of a virtual clubhouse where they're all hanging out during the pandemic when they can't go to school and they can't see their friends in person. And in that Discord server, they are trading racist and anti-Semitic memes, jokes. They're looking at images of gore, like violence on the battlefield. They are displaying like a real insensitivity that you would probably associate with just, you know, idiot teenage kids who also, though, happen to be into some really paranoid ideas about the government. You know, this is not to excuse any of their racist remarks, which many of them thought they were just being funny and, as they put it, edgy. But some of the really conspiratorial beliefs that they traded in, I found to be, you know, pretty troubling. For instance, I mean, Tashira was a big believer in this idea that the government, notably the FBI, had in many cases obtained evidence that individuals were about to commit mass shootings, like at the one at the supermarket in Buffalo some years ago, and let them happen so that they could create a pretext for tightening gun laws. Now, putting aside that this makes zero sense because we don't tighten gun laws in response to mass shootings in this country, it was also just this very sinister, dark idea about how the government works. And, you know, it was kind of in that atmosphere that he was stewing every day, right? And I think that, like, members of this server that we, Discord group that we talked to, really explained how the deeper they got into these ideas, particularly during the isolation of the pandemic, the more that they now see that they were becoming detached from reality and making really poor decisions. And, you know, when things that they said, racist remarks that they made, jokes that they made, resurfaced in the course of our reporting, many of them were really humiliated by it and felt very embarrassed and chagrined, understandably. But it was a pretty extremist, paranoid group of people. And I think that, you know, the fact that they were spending all of their waking hours online together created this echo chamber where they were all reinforcing their ideas about, you know, the government being evil. And the post-George Floyd killing protests, they became very worried that, you know, Black people were going to rise up and somehow, you know, come for white people in their neighborhoods. And this, you know, frankly, a lot of paranoia that you see in some kind of corners of the far right on the internet was kind of in microcosm with these kids.
Something that I find so striking about this story is how it's, as you sort of described, it's born of this like toxic soup of so much that plagues our society today. So like social isolation and the pandemic of loneliness during a larger COVID pandemic, casual conspiratorial thinking, and like the expression of racist beliefs purely for like shock and clout. I believe the clinical term is shitposting.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Yeah. Distrust of traditional media sources, parasocial online relationships. You've, as you said, you've managed to track down a few of the people who were in this, the kids who were in this group for your reporting. Did you get the sense that, I guess, at the time that they earnestly believed these things, or were they just, you know, doing it for clout, as they say?
I think it was a mixture of both. I think that there were some that probably didn't deeply think it, and they were saying it to be edgy or because, frankly, they just hadn't really thought it through, and all their friends were doing it, and, you know, I'll do it too, because people, it gets a rise out of people. And then there were others that clearly had internalized a lot of these beliefs and felt pretty strongly about them. I would put Jack Teixeira in that category based on things that, you know, we learned in our reporting. But it was definitely a mixture. And then, you know, people described Jack as being a leader of the group, as someone that other, particularly younger members of the group looked up to. And I think the fact that he was in the military and a bit older than some of these kids gave him a sense of authority and credibility. And I think that there's a lot of evidence that he used that and enjoyed being seen as a mentor and an older figure and driving a lot of the conversation, the racist and paranoid conversation that happened in the server.
When Russia invades Ukraine, this really kicks off, and Jack takes this authority and the access he has to classified information and weaponizes it, right?
Yeah, it's around the time of the invasion that he is posting a lot about what the U.S. knows about the pending invasion. And then after it happens, you know, kind of battlefield updates and up-to-the-minute information. He's sharing it both with his friends in this particular small Discord server. He's also posting it on a much bigger server, just kind of a more, you can think of it as a bit more of a public forum as opposed to this more clubhouse environment that he spent most of his time in. So he's posting in two places classified information about the war in Ukraine.
So his kind of fringy paranoid beliefs that he earnestly believed, was that more of a motivator for him to start posting this stuff in more of an ideological way in the sense of like how Edward Snowden did, or was it just he had it and he could?
I think it's more that he had it and he could. You know, I never got the sense from talking to friends or reading what Jack wrote that there was a sense of like, I'm going to expose government wrongdoing. He did feel that he saw things for how they really were, and that the normal people who didn't have this kind of access were missing. And he wanted to share those insights with his friends so that they would be informed and aware the way that he was. I don't think of that as an ideological motivation. I think of it more as kind of like a bit of like misguided sense of leadership. Like it was like he felt it was important that these young people, you know, really know what's going on. But he also clearly enjoyed being the one to tell them and being seen as an authority figure. I mean, there's a pedantic streak in all of this and the way that he could lecture people. Or we get upset when they weren't paying, as he felt, you know, close enough attention to all of this knowledge that he was dropping on them about the way the government really works and what's really going on in the world. But he never presented to me as someone who, like a Snowden, had articulated an idea about the public's right to know government malfeasance and what they were up to. You know, he wasn't leaking this stuff to journalists. When he was posting it on Discord, he didn't think that it was going to be widely disseminated. And in some cases, of course, he was posting it, you know, anonymously under a screen name, not his own actual name.
So this information that he was sharing leaves the kind of sheltered cocoon that they had on Discord, and it gets to people like yourself and then the Pentagon. How did he react as, I guess you could say, the walls were closing in?
Suffice to say, he freaked out, probably. He got very nervous. You know, he seemed to understand even before the news widely broke that the Pentagon was looking into this. You know, we've never been able to pin that down, but he seemed to have some kind of advanced idea of this. But once the news broke and news organizations started reporting on these documents floating around the internet, the evidence is that he immediately recognized these were documents that he had shared with his friends and that they had broken free, as you said, of this kind of cocoon. He started destroying computer equipment. He destroyed his phone. He told people he'd interacted with to go back and delete messages that contained classified information that he'd posted. He essentially nuked or entirely deleted the small Discord server that he was in. And, you know, all of this has been, you know, both documented by our reporting and by the FBI's investigation. He tried to cover his tracks. And I think that that is pretty clear evidence that he knew that, you know, the government was likely to come looking for him. And it was being reported at the time that the FBI was looking for the source of this. So he knew that the walls were closing out on him. And I think that, you know, that's, you know, he has since pleaded guilty. So I think we can say this is evidence that he understood that, you know, that he had a crime.
Yeah. So he was an airman first class at the time of his arrest with the specialty cyber transport systems journeyman. Is that just a fancy way of saying he was an IT guy? Like, what did he do in his squadron?
Yes, that's a fancy way of saying like he's a tech. You know, I mean, and it's funny because, you know, I used to sort of say to editors when we were first starting this story, I said, you know, he's like the HVAC guy. You know, it's like he has to come into the house and repair your HVAC, but you don't expect him that he's going to look through your drawers and your files while he's doing it. When the Air Force later came out with an Inspector General report, interestingly, they found out that one of his actual jobs was to monitor the HVAC system at work to make sure the air conditioner was going to keep the computers cooled down. My point is that this is not someone who was engaged in sophisticated analysis. He had no reason to be looking at any of these documents. His job was to keep the computers running. He was like the help desk guy. even, and it's interesting, when he was caught looking at these documents, his bosses, who could tell he was interested in them, actually offered him the opportunity to get training as an analyst, and he declined that. Not clear why, but like they could tell, like, you know, hey, you seem to be interested in doing this job that is definitely not your job. If you're not going to go train to do that job, then stop poking around these networks. Just make sure that, you know, they're working. That's your job.
As you said, he wasn't an analyst or some sort of a sensor operator or something. Like, yeah, he was an IT guy and mostly worked overnight shifts. Is that the case?
Yeah. In fact, it's because he was on the overnight shift, the Air Force investigation found there weren't that many people around, which made it easier for him to print out documents without anyone noticing.
So in the night, he's sort of alone in this skiff for large periods of time and can just sort of, with his clearance, log on to Intellipedia or JWix or any number of these databases at will and just print out whatever he wanted. In your discussions with the Air Force, other experts, does the IT guy need access to the contents of those systems? I mean, like, if I wrote in a chapter that some character was just printing out reams of documents that they had no real operational need to know, I don't think anyone would believe that it was that easy.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a great question. And I think it's one that, frankly, the military is still struggling with. Do they need access to the documents? No. But is seeing the documents an inevitable occurrence when they are working on the computer systems that house the documents? Yes. At least as the way the technology is constructed right now. It's sort of like you can't, you know, I'll use another like, maybe clumsy analogy, but it's like, you know, if you are the guy repairing the refrigerator, like you're going to see the contents of the refrigerator. You can't repair it without seeing them. But it's also not like Jack Teixeira would be working on these networks and suddenly he's just confronted by hundreds of classified documents. I mean, he would have to go into, you know, files and systems and branch down into them. So it's really, I think, more that in the course of doing his work, he would be likely to run across documents. He might see top lines. He might even have to open up, let's say, a file and look inside of it. But what he's really supposed to do is just kind of ignore it and not retain that information. And he's not supposed to, you know, transcribe it on paper as he did. He's not supposed to print it out and take pictures of it as he did. Now, some experts that we talked to in the course of our reporting said, look, there's a way that you could use technology to essentially put up like gates or barriers in front of these different networks or subdirectories, if you want to think of them that way, such that if somebody like Jack Teixeira were poking around in them, it might say, hey, hold on a second. It doesn't seem like for your tech job, you need to be doing this. So what are you doing here? What's this about? Or do you need to have somebody looking over your shoulder while you do it? And I think that those are kind of like, you know, solutions that the military is probably going to try and implement now to prevent things like this from happening in the future. But I think the broader problem is that, you know, after 9/11, the government went from this, the intelligence community and the government went from this model of intelligence of access on a need-to-know basis, which meant that, you know, things were kind of siloed and put in their own files and you only got access to things that you had a need to know, towards what was called need to share.
The fusion.
Yeah, exactly. The philosophy behind it was like, look, we have to make all of this intelligence available to a large number of people across the intelligence community and the military, because we can't predict when this, you know, one piece of intelligence that Shane is working on is going to be of interest to this thing that Matt's working on, but they're not talking to one another, but they might make a connection. And of course, that makes total sense if you're trying to prevent something like 9/11, where we know that the CIA, for instance, didn't tell the FBI that Al-Qaeda members it was monitoring had arrived in the United States, and some of those guys turned out to be the hijackers. So you can see why the need for sharing is important. But what it's done is create this system where, because the kind of the information space has been flattened out and everyone who has a security clearance can now kind of hop on JWix if they want, that's what means that that's why it is that like a 21-year-old tech like Jack Teixeira can hop on there the same way that, you know, a GS-15 analyst at the CIA working on the Russia can do it.
Right. Apart from the concerns about his accessing all this classified material while on the job. It was reported in his squadron that there were other sort of more personal concerns with him. I believe it was quoted somewhere, a colleague of his saying that he was basically like met all the red flags for like a mass shooter.
Yeah, so that's right. There were a number of colleagues who felt that way. Apparently some called him at work the mass shooter kid.
Yeah, that's not good.
It's not good. No, it's not. And what this stemmed from is an understanding that some of them had, I guess some of them at work had found out that when he was in high school, he had been suspended for threatening to bring a gun to school. And you know, we were able to obtain through a records request, it took some doing, the police report by the local police there who responded at his school. And, you know, what you see, I have to say, is not just like an offhand dumb remark by a stupid kid who making a joke. It's many students and teachers saying, no, he talks about guns all the time. He talks about bringing guns to school. He makes violent threats towards Black people. He said, I want to kill all Black people. There are teachers who had gone through active shooter training who, once they went out, said, oh, Jack is exhibiting the signs of a potential shooter. Like, it's that kid. And what was so important about that is that this comes up in his background check for when he is applying for a security clearance. And the government, for reasons that we still don't understand, the Defense Department, I should say, determines that that is not enough of a reason to deny him a clearance. So they give him what's called a favorable adjudication, and he gets a clearance. Well, when he gets to work at this airbase, Otis Air Base on Cape Cod, people at work find out about this. We think because he tells them about it. You know, he's also still talking about his interest in guns, and people understandably become very nervous. And what was so interesting to me is the Air Force Inspector General who looked at this found that, look, it's one thing, you know, one problem was that you saw this kid looking at classified documents multiple times and didn't pull him off the line and suspend him. He let him keep doing it. But they said, had you also taken more seriously this red flag that he had in his past, you might have said, hey, kid looking at intelligence documents he's not supposed to, exhibiting defiant behavior, there's also this weird thing about guns in his background. This should even have elevated alarm even more, is what the Air Force said. When they should have said, well, you put these things together and you should have seen that you were dealing with a potentially volatile individual who had no regard for rules. And that's ultimately, you know, what they got. I mean, they're saying basically, had you taken the gun threat more seriously, you may have responded more seriously to the fact that he was looking at classified documents when he shouldn't have been.
Okay. Aside from concerns that were raised by others in the squadron, right, he has this documented in a police report, this documented history of being obsessed with weapons, making all kinds of racist statements and stuff all through high school, right, about killing ATF agents and other federal officials. I mean, teenage boys say and think and do stupid things all the time. It's in their nature, right? And nobody wants to be haunted for the rest of their lives by mistakes that they make as a kid. But Teixeira was still this person when he enlisted, right? And I don't think you have to be like George Smiley or the ghost of James Angleton to see that this is like a potential issue. Does this point to some sort of greater systemic insider threat issue inside the country's national security enterprise?
I think it does. We were struck by the relative ease of his getting a security clearance, the warning signs that were ignored. I was also struck by the Air Force Inspector General report, which usually government reports are pretty dryly written. You read this one and you can tell that the investigators are just baffled by the security breakdowns that occurred inside this intelligence unit, where, you know, as I said, he's observed multiple times reading classified documents that he shouldn't have been. They have these meetings inside his unit where the commanding officer, in an effort to demonstrate what a serious mission they all have in doing support for the military, starts holding up classified documents as an example of the kind of work that they do. And then the investigators are saying, you don't need to do that. Like, why are you being cavalier and tossing around classified documents? I think suggesting that they were creating an atmosphere in which rules for handling classified documents just weren't very well respected. So you kind of go through every point in the chain of how he got a clearance in the first place, why didn't the background investigators talk to his friends on Discord? I mean, we still don't know who the background investigator interviewed. Traditionally, they would talk to maybe your neighbors, maybe classmates, maybe family members, maybe employers. There is no obligation for an applicant to disclose their social media history, to say, here are my Discord usernames. And we're living in an era in which people who want security clearances, you know, we all have significant online lives. And in Jack's case, his most significant relationships were online, not in real life. And so if you really wanted a picture of Jack Teixeira, you had to talk to his Discord friends. Otherwise, you're missing this whole piece of him. Had they talked to one or even two of those people, they might have surfaced, you know, the racism, the paranoia, the threats to ATF agents, the things that were just common occurrences for him. And so I think that's a huge hole in the way that the government protects classified information and grants clearances. And then clearly at this base in Otis, at Otis Air Force Base, there was just a breakdown in an understanding of what having a clearance even means. Like the idea that having a clearance just means you can look at whatever you want. The Air Force Inspector General found that that was a misperception there. I have to believe that if it's happening at this Air National Guard base in Massachusetts, it's happening at other intelligence facilities as well. Maybe not in the CIA proper, who knows? But it's some of these kind of outposts that are doing intel support work where perhaps they don't have as much of a history with protecting information and they're young, you know, I think maybe this is more commonplace. And who knows, maybe it's happening at NSA and CIA too, but it was a pretty baffling breakdown that I think is probably not unique to this one ability.
No, that's always something that's really stood out to me about this, even from the start, just how egregious and obvious it was. His squadron was under the larger 102nd Intelligence Wing. What sort of consequences has there been for that wing's mission and its leadership?
The commanding officer, I believe, was relieved, and there's been some other senior level discipline. For a time, their work on intelligence support was suspended. I think the future of that work is a little bit TBD at this point, but you know, there hasn't been any kind of discipline higher up than that. All of it has been very isolated to Otis Air National Guard base and to the facility, the intelligence support wing there, which is not to say that I would expect that there would be any more higher level, you know, firings. I mean, this seems like a pretty isolated, you know, this incident was isolated to that base. But what I'm very curious to know is whether or not the people who approved his security clearance are going to come in for any kind of scrutiny or the process itself. But the immediate fallout was at fairly senior levels there at the intelligence support wing.
We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be right back with more.
Have these leaks, to your knowledge, resulted in any sort of permanent or lasting harm to U.S. intelligence sources and methods?
I don't think that they have. And that's one of the things that's been notable about these leaks is that they were highly revelatory, particularly when it came to what U.S. officials knew and estimated about the war in Ukraine and the likelihood for success of the counteroffensive, which hadn't happened yet. Basically showing that U.S. officials knew privately that the situation in Ukraine was more dire than they portrayed it publicly. As far as I know, though, there has not been a leak that led to a source or a method of acquiring intelligence drying up. That said, you know, there are some documents that spoke to or revealed sourcing that was highly sensitive that we either did not publish because we determined it was so sensitive, or we withheld at the request of government officials, and including in European governments, not just the United States. So there was some stuff in there that definitely it was, you know, if it had gotten out more widely, it could have potentially done damage. But this has not been a case where, like with the Snowden leaks, where, you know, many government officials have attested that there were lines of collection that were compromised and dried up because of those leaks. We haven't seen that with a Discord base.
There's been some resolution to this story earlier this week. So we're recording this on March 7th. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so that was on Monday of this week. We're talking, as you said, March 7th. Jack Teixeira appeared in a district court in Massachusetts and changed his earlier plea of not guilty to guilty on six counts, including the willful retention and dissemination of national defense intelligence. So leaking. That's the legal way for saying leaking. So he took responsibility for everything that he was charged with. And I was there in the courtroom with my colleague, Sam Oakford. It was a notable event because in the past year that we've been writing about Jack Teixeira, we had never been in a room with him. I mean, he was in jail by the time we discovered, or I'd been arrested at the time we discovered who he was. And so we never had access to him. So just physically being 15 feet from him was kind of an interesting experience. But he stood there and talked to the judge. And as the prosecution went through all of the charges and what they would prove at trial, which is all the things that we've been talking about that he was alleged to have done, the judge said, you know, do you understand and acknowledge that if you went to trial, they would be able to prove this? And he said, yes, Your Honor, I do. So he admitted to it. He will be sentenced later in September. His lawyers are asking for an 11-year prison sentence. The government is asking for closer to 17 years, 16 years and 8 months. So he is going to spend somewhere between 11 and 16 years in prison, which as stiff of a penalty as that is, I think is actually a pretty good deal for him because he was looking at potentially 25 to 30 years, if not more. So, you know, if he serves 11 years, he'll get out when he's 32, 33, and still have much of his life ahead of him, which considering the brazenness of his actions as the prosecution sees it, would be a fairly generous outcome for him, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Part of the plea agreement, as I understand it, was that he'll cooperate with the feds in a full damage assessment of what classified information he released and how far it might have spread. Do you have any details you can share about that?
We don't know about that yet, and that will be conducted by the Defense Department and the intelligence community. But I think what we can presume will happen, as these things generally, it's a pretty typical element of a plea deal like this, is that he will have to sit down with investigators and say exactly how he did it. And I think he will probably be expected to, the best of his recollection, talk about individual users that were in the Discord server. And the ones that the government has keyed in on in its public statements and in its court filings are foreign nationals who were in the Discord server. It's something that we learned very early on when we were interviewing members of the server that, yeah, there were people who seemed to have been in Ukraine and possibly in Russia. The government's going to want to know everything he can tell them about that. And that's also going to be really important because when the FBI was pursuing Jack, he deleted the Discord server where he shared this information. And we interviewed executives at Discord who told us that they have no record of that server. So the evidence that could have helped investigators, like say, okay, get the screen names of the people, the handles that were in these rooms, that's gone. So it's going to require, to some degree, Jack Teixeira, I would suspect, trying to remember individual stream names and accounts that he could tell them so that the government could follow up on that and, you know, find out whether those people were working for a foreign government or had their computers hacked by a foreign government.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question. Just be clear about that point. That does the government suspect that any of the foreign nationals in that server were there on purpose for that reason?
To my knowledge, no. But I can't definitively say that because I don't know if the answer is no. But to my knowledge, no. And he was not charged with, giving it to a foreign national.
Yeah. Before we wrap up here, as I said at the top of the show, you and your colleagues at the Post have been deeply involved in covering this story from the start. You partnered with PBS's Frontline on a documentary about Teixeira and the leaks. You've reported on pretty much every major U.S. national security story in the last 20 years. Is there something about this one in particular or how you've covered it that's felt different or special to you?
Yeah. And in fact, I'm glad you asked that because it reminds me of, you know, when Sam and I first started reporting the story and we're talking to somebody who knew Teixeira from this Discord server. And, you know, we're coming into the story talking to this person, not knowing, okay, how do these classified documents end up online? Where did they come from? And this, you know, person starts telling this story about this, you know, young guy working for the military who is sharing documents to impress a bunch of teenagers, essentially. And I remember distinctly kind of looking at Sam with this look like, are we hearing this correctly? Because I've covered a lot of leak investigations. You know, they're usually done by people who have a political motivation. They want to expose what they see as wrongdoing. They may have some kind of axe to grind on a policy level. I've never seen a leaker who did it to impress a bunch of teenagers. And I kind of had to, like, I felt a little thrown off by this because of that. This just sounds implausible. What is going on here? This doesn't make sense. And, you know, for me, because I, you know, I report on, you know, government officials and, you know, grown-ups, basically, they don't always behave like grown-ups, but to kind of become immersed into this world of teens in on a gaming platform as being at the epicenter of one of these huge national security leaks, that was just unique for me. I'd never experienced anything like that. But the more that we got into it, it became apparent to me, and I think to Sam too, that this is precisely where future leaks might come from. Because you have this environment in which so many people have access to classified documents and could be sharing them online with friends. And in fact, since Jack Teixeira's arrest, we've seen a couple more instances of people letting documents at work, sharing them with people online. In some cases, they're accused with actual espionage. So I think that what we kind of came onto here is perhaps like what the future of leaking is going to look like.
Yeah, I think that's a, you make an interesting point there. There's a quote in one of the articles you've put out over the year that was a friend of his on the Discord server who was like full on sobbing when Teixeira got arrested. And he said, well, like, well, he's my best friend. And I mean, I'm only like a generation removed from these kids. But to me, that's not a friendship. You know, it's this weird kind of quasi thing in between. And you think of like the classical counterintelligence thing that like, okay, some voluptuous blonde sits next to an intelligence officer at a hotel bar, you know, and it sort of begins that way. But this just opens up a whole new spectrum of potential issues here.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that there's long been a concern in government that foreign intelligence services could target people through gaming platforms. So you can imagine a scenario in which it's not Jack Teixeira or a Jack Teixeira-like person doing the leaking, but rather that person is being worked over and targeted by a foreign spy who says, you know, like, oh, show me some of the things that you see at work. Oh, I'm so impressed. It's so interesting. There's been a case in the news in the past week that looks like that, actually, that we're just starting to look into. But I think, you know, it's, and you mentioned, you know, the kid who said, who was sobbing when Jack was arrested, and I've lost my best friend. I don't think that that person fully understood the degree to which Jack Teixeira had put him at risk.
Yeah.
That put him at legal risk. These kids got very lucky. And what's interesting to me is I can tell you that one person who did very much appreciate the risk that Jack Teixeira had put that kid in was his mother, who was not. and as part of this, I mean, in this experience, we did talk to the parents of some of these people who were minors when we were talking to them. We needed permission from their parents. And, you know, I think a lot of these parents were just bewildered by what their kids were doing online. They didn't know. I mean, they're on the computer playing games. Who are these friends they're talking to? I don't know. And, you know, when we first reported on these stories, so many friends and colleagues came to me like in the office or just emailed me and said, you know, my kid is on Discord and I'd have no idea what he is doing. And it just revealed to people that that this is not them just playing a game, that they are in fact in a community online. These relationships are meaningful to them. They're spending hours of their waking time with these people and their parents have no clue who they are.
Yeah. Well, we'll leave it on that note. Where can listeners find more about your work?
You can read my work at The Washington Post. You can also follow me on Twitter at Shane Harris. But if you just Google Shane Harris Washington Post, you'll get a list on the site of all my recent articles, and you can read those there.
Yeah, well, we'll have links to that in the show notes, including the Frontline documentary that you guys worked on. That was really well done, and I think listeners will find it quite interesting. Shane Harris, thanks so much for coming on. It's always great to speak with you.
Yeah, you too, Matt. Thanks for having me.
Listening. This is Secrets and Spies.